Access number 12149, reel 17.
Captain Sutton, reel 17.
The original claim had been incorrect and overstated, and that the true figure was, say, 13 instead of 17. Admiral Vaughan was furious at our method of operating aircraft. He considered that by not attacking the specific targets he'd given us, that this was cowardice and that we were not carrying out his orders. He also considered that to disallow claims by pilots was completely wrong, and if the pilots claimed that they had hit an aircraft, then they were to be allowed that as a kill. So we were ordered that on no account were we to divert aircraft for photographic reconnaissance for future targets, and that pilots' claims were to be accepted and were not to be disputed. Well, this was a completely non-professional view, and one can see that for a gunnery officer admiral who's used to practicing on targets, that he considered his air crew, in effect, to be missiles, that they were really humans guiding missiles for him and to be directed according to his orders. There was to be no deviation. The result was that we were ordered, in effect, to gain no intelligence. So we then, from then onwards, this must be the last two series of operations against Japan, we were then attacking airfields which we had not photographed, and not reconnoitred. We didn't know what was there. We went down, and the pilots were searching for aircraft, and searching for aircraft in the face of very heavy anti-aircraft fire in most cases, and when they couldn't find any, were then, if necessary, setting fire to the woods around in the hope that this might at least burn up any aircraft which had been hidden away off the airfield perimeter. This isn't the way to conduct war. It is completely inefficient. And at the end of the operations, just before the surrender of Japan, Vaughan came on board to say how well we had done, and this, that, and the other. And he gave a rather stupid speech. He said that once we had obeyed orders and hadn't pulled our punches, that we had done quite well and come up to the standard that he expected of an aircraft carrier. Now, the air crews, when they were being handled professionally and were given a full intelligence of what they were going for, had been fully elated. When they had then been forced to attack blind, their morale had gone down. And when Vaughan then made his rather stupid speech, there was a series of catcalls from the junior pilots, the fighter pilots who were in the wardroom to be addressed by the admiral. And a whole group of young men went bow, wow, 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 wow to the admiral. Now,
what was the significance of that?
That was your yapping. This group, incidentally, I think, were very largely, we had a squadron almost entirely of old Etonians arranged to come together, and I think it was they who actually were so infuriated by the admiral. And they considered a typical old-fashioned admiral didn't understand what he was doing. Anyhow, Vaughan went out of the room, white with anger, steam coming out of his ears, being placated by Charles Evans and by Hughes Hallett. And that was that. Now, unfortunately for me, I was the author of the instigator of the method of attack and of the provider of all the intelligence and the organization that went behind it. And I was blamed by Vian for what happened. In fact, I think all the blame was piled on me, as far as it could be. We withdrew from the area, we went down to Sydney, we had a victory march and that sort of thing, and then I left the ship. I probably might not have left the ship if I hadn't angered Vian, but he was furious with me, and I think, it's difficult to say, but I think that also he was, his staff blamed me as well for our method of operating aircraft. It was my method of operating aircraft, it was very efficient too. Anyhow, my name was Mudd. I was first of all used to evacuate prisoners of war, having left the ship. The ship went over to what was called the air group system. We had not been on it, so that all the air operations, including the conduct of operations and all supporting operations, went under one senior officer. The other ships had done this before the end of the war. Now Implacable went over to it and I left. So Charles Evans became the commander, flying in every way over the whole of the ship, and a more junior operations officer took my place and I left. First job was to get out prisoners of war. I was given a team of Navy, Army, Air Force, mainly men who had been prisoners of war in Europe and were sent out to get prisoners out of the Japanese prisoner of war camps. If necessary, they were to be parachuted in, but in effect, the Japanese had surrendered, and therefore it was a matter really of administering them and getting them out. I went up through the islands. The first lot that I got out were a whole mass of Indian troops from I can't remember, Babeltrop or Palau, one of those two islands, and they were on the verge of dying of starvation. The Americans actually set up a small CB establishment in Palau, I think it was, and they brought these former Indian troops and Indonesian troops over in landing craft, and then I was there with my officers and received them in the mess hall. And the incredible sight as the as they came in, and the whisper went back. You could hear it interpreted in the various languages. The British officers, and they came by, straightened up, smartened, saluted, and I was asked by the first one who came to me, and he said, "And what are you?" And I said, "I'm a commander in the British Navy." And he said, "You are a British officer?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "I am so happy, I am so glad, I am so happy to be with the British officers again." And then he said, turned round and told all the other people. And there was sort of cheer, and then they came past. This was men who had rarely been dying, and indeed a third of them did die within the next two or three weeks, very largely malnutrition. It's difficult to say what you died of. Some of them died of overeating, unfortunately. I went on, left I think two or three people were there behind to administer them, and then went on up to the Philippines, where I worked under an Australian brigadier, under an American general, getting out prisoners of war. They came in to the Philippines from all over the place. They came in from Hong Kong, from Japan itself, from Manchuria. We had most of the general staff from Singapore came through, who'd been up in senior officers' camp in Manchuria. We had the ship's company of the Exeter and other ships that had been sunk in the Battle of the Java Sea. And in every case, what we were after, what I'd been told to do, and my men had been certainly not trained to do, was to interrogate them all and to find out what had happened. How they had been taken prisoner, what had happened to their unit, what had happened to their messmates, what had happened when they were in the prisoner of war camp, what atrocities had been committed, because one was trying to get at war criminals before they went underground. One had complete lists of ships' companies, and of other units, naval units, etc., have been serving ashore, and merchant navy, ships' companies, and one tried to cross-check onto each man, asking everybody, did you know so-and-so, what happened to him, did you see him, was he... you say he was killed, how was he killed, he was drowned, did you actually see him drown, and so on, trying to cross-check in every way. And this worked quite well, complete interrogation teams going through these men and then processing them and getting them away, being put on ships sent across the Pacific to the west coast of Canada, then across Canada back home. We tried to get quite a number of the former China side hands, the men who had been in trading ashore in China, men who had been in tramp ships and the other up and down the coast of China, back to Hong Kong or to China, and the Americans weren't having it. They say, we've won the war out here. The proper place of Britain's is Britain, and that's where you're going. And that's where they went. They wanted us out. At one stage, the American general said to me that they had sufficient personnel to process the remainder of our former prisoners. I said my job was to see the last of them out. He said, I want you to go now with your staff, and I will see the rest of these on their way. And I said, when they've gone, I'll go. And so he then tried to squeeze us out. We found that in the area we've been assigned, the tented area, that as we gradually got rid of our prisoners, they were filled up with Negro troops, which the Americans at that stage, I mean, you wouldn't worry about Negro troops these days, but just in 1945, to have the Negroes using your mess hall, your latrines, everything else, was a definite way of trying to squeeze you out. You're going to get you out, you bloody limeys. And that was it. They were very arrogant, and they said, we've won the war, and we want the pickings. I went down with dysentery. I got a very bad attack of dysentery. I'm living amongst all these people who had dysentery. I mean, they're an incredible sight. The ones who had, most of them all had malnutrition. You put your finger into a chap and the hollow, the dent remained because he had beriberi or this, that, and the other. They were in an awful state. Great distended stomachs as they started to feed, otherwise emaciated faces and the skeletons. You had to hold them back and restrain them. The Captain Gordon, the captain of the Exeter, who was up in the mountains in Japan and was brought down from there, said that if they'd been in Japan another year, another winter, they'd have died, a lot of them, he reckoned. They were just given sufficient food to keep them going and being used as coolie labour. If you didn't work, then you died. I was flown down to Australia And I went into hospital outside Sydney, where I was filled full of the new sulfur drugs. And what they did to me, I don't know, terrible things, almost certainly. But the doctors, of course, were experimenting. Sulfur drugs could kill dysentery. I was given MMB tablets, as they called them, Mbeko, the first inventor of sulfur drugs. I was given 8 tablets about every 4 hours. I mean, nearly, I mean, they're just about to kill you, but it killed the dysentery. What else it did to me, I don't know. Never shall know. But they absolutely toasted out of me. And then there was a period of waiting. I was appointed as the, still as an acting commander, as the executive officer of the Naval Air Station at Kai Tak in Hong Kong. The Navy in the last year and a half of war developed mobile naval operational air bases, MONABs. Mobile operational air, you know, that's it, yes, which was mobile workshops, lorries, this, that, and the other, all sorts of things. It established one in Hong Kong. Got in there almost immediately after Hong Kong was relieved by Admiral Harcourt and his force of cruisers and things had gone in there. And they settled themselves down in Kai Tak Airfield. Now, Kai Tak Airfield was a former RAF airfield before the war. And so the Navy, under a captain called Surtees, had moved in and had established themselves on the airfield. And to make quite certain it was Navy, this chap put his camp down in the middle of the airfield between the runways. This is a very dicey position to have a living accommodation. But he established his right to the airfield and tried to edge the Air Force off it. God, he was stupid. I arrived up there about mid-December flown up from Australia and became the executive officer. He was very disappointed. He hadn't been given a proper commander, that I was merely a lieutenant commander wearing a brass hat. And we had a strange business up there. It was just after the Japanese had been turned out. The place was full of bandits. We were raided almost continuously. Everybody was terribly poor, and it was a cold, hard winter. And life is cheap in China. So they'd come in and steal, and so he got killed stealing. That was too bad. They didn't mind so much.
These were burglaries?
Breaking into the airfield. We had gangs of bandits breaking in. I wired our section of the airfield right round our bit. Then the next bit was the Air Force bit, and that was left unwired. But I reckon if I wired our bit, at least the Air Force would be more attractive to attack than our bit. And I also realized that if they were coming in, they got to cut the wire. And so one could tell where they were coming in, because one would do a dusk patrol, note where the wire had been cut, and they didn't necessarily lay an ambush. These are all sorts of things I'd learned when I was with the army. It's worked. Later on, after the war, when I was captain of an airfield out in Malta, I employed the same sort of thing again. I partly wired an airfield and diverted the thefts. But this is it. Everybody said, oh, it's absolutely crazy. You can't wire in an airfield. No, I said, I'm not wiring an airfield. I'm merely restricting the attack. And that's what I did. We'd conducted quite a battle with gangs working to attack the airfield and steal. We killed one or two Chinese. In retaliation, they would snipe us. So we had quite a lot of airfield equipment, or we could borrow it from the Air Force. So what I did was I went out and the great big mobile cranes, airfield construction cranes, I lifted the Japanese pillboxes, which the Japanese had put around various parts of the mainland covering the beaches, picked them up, and dumped them down my airfield. So I had a series of Japanese pillboxes, and the bullets pinged off the cement from then onwards. Oh, it was good fun. I was there for about 6 months. We had a large force of Japanese prisoners of war assigned to us to work on the airfield, dirt airfield, a lot of work to be done. We had to dig irrigation ditches, not irrigation, what do you call it? Flood control ditches. Because the place became absolutely covered in water in the winter. So we put ditches to take it away. We removed the aircraft pens that the Japanese had built of earth because they'd become nests of rats. I don't know a lot about rats. After I demolished two, and the rats had moved. The next one I went to, I surrounded with sailors and was about to demolish it, and the sailors with gaiters on and cudgels to kill the rats. And a sailor came up to me, had been on guard the previous night. He says, "Aren't you there, sir?" I said, "What do you mean, aren't you there?" He said, "A column of rats left that pen last night. I saw it in the moonlight, just like the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Incredible." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "That's it." He said, "They knew you were coming and they've all gone." And he was right. When we removed that pen, there were no rats. They had left. We learned a lot. We had, let's say, about 600 Japanese prisoners of war. We put them on to building roads. I got the Army, the Royal Engineers, to teach me how to build roads, and my petty officers, and we were in charge of Japanese working parties, and we built roads, because it was a quagmire otherwise on that dirt airfield. And all sorts of things. We built guard houses of stone. We built one thing we built, which wasn't a success, was an armory. And my gunnery officer, my armament officer, said that he knew precisely how to build an armory, that he had built air raid shelters in England before he joined the Navy, and that he could build us a large armory. And so this was built, and I thought that it looked a bit strange. So I got in the airfield works and brick strap from the Air Force to look at it. He said, "For Christ's sake, don't take away the shuttering. The whole thing's going to collapse." He said, "You've got to have pillars here to support it. Put those in, it'll be all right." So I told that my officer, no account was the shuttering to be removed. He didn't believe me. And he went there early in the morning with a friend, and he knocked away all the shattering, and the bloody thing whole collapsed. He just escaped his life. Several years later, when I was a captain of a frigate, he applied to come to sea with me as my gunnery officer. I made quite certain he didn't come near my ship. About June, I suppose it was, July
1946,
I was recalled home. All these units abroad were being closed down. The instead of having a captain in command, there was a commander in command. Instead of having a commander, a second in command, there was a lieutenant commander being put in command, in second in command, and so on. The thing was being stepped down. In a way, it was a good thing. I'd been an acting commander quite a long time, and came back and took up a job in the Admiralty as a 2½. I had been a commander since 1943, and we were in 46. I might say that when I put on an ordinary naval officer's cap again, instead of that brass cap, it felt like a little pimple on my head. But I had enough faith in myself to change back one uniform to 2½ stripes only, and kept the rest as commander stripes. So that was it. That was the end of the war. There was one other thing that did happen at Kai Tak that would interest you, I think, and that was the RAF mutiny. The RAF had been in... it was the tail end, right at the end of the Transport Command network, Kai Tak, which went through Saigon and round to India and back to the UK. And as DMOB developed, the Air Force saw that they were going to be the last out. It's rather like sort of painting yourself into a corner, that the Transport Command is going to bring everybody else home, and there was going to be nobody to bring them home, or so they thought. And so they mutinied. And we had 3 days of the RAF refusing to do any work. The government called it a strike, the Labour government then. They said that there were certain units that got on strike, but it's a bloody mutiny. And we kept our unit going, the other end of the airfield, pretending that the Air Force didn't exist and turning our backs on them. we actually held a sports meeting and a few other things like that. But it was quite a situation with the half the airfield in mutiny. They weren't actually fighting, but just weren't working.